Code Monkey, get up, get coffee. Code Monkey, go to job. Code Monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob. Rob say Code Monkey, very diligent, but its output stink. Is code not function or elegant? What do Code Monkey think? Code Monkey think maybe manager won't arrive. Goddamn luck and page himself. Code Monkey not clean out loud. Code Monkey not crazy, just proud. Code Monkey like Frito. Code Monkey like Tab and Mountain Dew. Code Monkey very simple man. Big warm fuzzy secret heart. Code Monkey like you. Code Monkey like you.
Hello and welcome to Building with Rust, a podcast where we talk to the people working with and within the Rust programming language. I'm your host, Sean Chen, and today we're talking to Ralph Jung. Ralph is a postdoctoral researcher currently at the Max Planck Institute for Software Systems, where he's a member of the Rust Belt team working on defining and developing rigorous foundations for the Rust programming language. Ralph, along with collaborators Joshua Yanovsky, Honghai Dong, and Derek Dreyer, recently published a paper for a new Rust crate called Ghost Cell, which I found super fascinating when I was reading it. Naturally, I had to get Ralph on the podcast to chat with him about his research into Ghost Cell. Anyways, without further ado, let's go ahead and get started. Ralph, how's it going?
I'm fine, great, thanks. Getting a bit late here, but time zones are fun.
For sure. Cool. Let's just kind of launch right into the meat and potatoes, as they say. So Ghost Cell, this paper that you worked on with a bunch of collaborators, was something that I was really kind of interested in when that first came out and was kind of making the rounds on Twitter, and I opened it up and read it. Let me go ahead and kind of first try to summarize it to the best of my knowledge, and we can then get a bunch of clarifications from you, I'm sure, because I'm going to probably butcher some things. As far as I understand with Ghost Cell, it starts off with the motivation that Rust, generally speaking, has what you called in the paper aliasing XOR mutability. So this idea that when you have, when you're looking at some piece of data, you either have shared access to it, which means, you know, multiple sources can be reading from that data and not mutating it. Or on the flip side, you have one source with unique mutable access. So that's not news. That's nothing novel to the paper. That's just kind of laying the groundwork for what then was talked about in the paper, which is this observation that when you kind of have this model, when we then are talking about specifically like data structures, such as when you have data structure, like a lot of like kind of node-based data structures. So a classic example that you all used in the paper was like a doubly linked list, where it's not clear who has or who should own a particular node in a doubly linked list.
And we like to talk it in degree greater one data structures is basically the idea, right? If your in degree is one, like if you have only one pointer to everything, then you have a tree essentially, and then basic aliasing XOR mutation, the normal Rust ownership, just works fine. I mean, you just have boxes all the way down and like a singly linked list with no shared tails, and then Rust just works out of the box. But once you have in degree greater one, you kind of have aliasing automatically, and then you get into trouble, as every Rust programmer knows, once you want to also mutate something.
Yeah. And so Rust currently does not provide, or at least I should say kind of in the standard library, doesn't provide a great way to kind of get around this. So kind of the quote unquote standard way to get around this is to basically use interior mutability. So using like the standard cell type from the standard library, or perhaps, you know, if you need concurrent access, then maybe you're upgrading to like a mutex or something like that.
No, you might need the ref cell even for sequential code here, because you might not be able to always copy the data. Maybe you want to just access it by reference. Right? If you use cell, you have to copy everything all the time.
Right. But the problem with kind of this sort of the strategy when you're working with data structures that have greater than one in degree, as you mentioned, it requires a lot of runtime checks. So basically, we're kind of opting out of the compile time checks that the compiler usually would be doing for us to check that the aliasing XOR mutability rules are being followed. Instead, we're kind of like offloading those onto when the code is actually run at runtime instead of at compile time. And so in that case, there's performance overhead as a result of kind of going with this strategy so that you're just kind of able to even use these data structures or collections in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, if you do this with a linked list, you end up basically with a mutex per node, which is, I mean, which if you have highly concurrent accesses to the same list by multiple threads, maybe that's what you need. But most of the time, it's just ridiculous, right? You don't want a mutex per node. Why should you have that?
Right, and you mentioned this example in the paper where, yeah, you know, as you just said, even if you wanted to just iterate through a linked list that was implemented in this way with Rust's kind of standard interior mutability tools, then you were basically almost like unlocking a mutex just to access every single node in the linked list when you're performing the iteration. So yes, at that point, it is very suboptimal and performance definitely takes a bit of a nosedive, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, so to be concrete here, the kind of model we are thinking of is a data structure like the ones in the standard library, like your VEC, right? VEC is where if you have exclusive access, then you can mutate it anywhere you want, but you also know there's no other threads doing anything. Or you have shared access, and then there can be many threads doing read-only things. So it's basically, again, aliasing XOR mutation on the data structure level. What we are explicitly not talking about is proper concurrent data structures, right? Like a concurrent hash map where you do have many threads. So you have aliasing, but you want to insert and query in all the threads. That's a very different situation. And then you want to do clever things and you want to do fine-grained locking or atomic operations or whatever. That's not what we are thinking about here. What we're thinking about here is standard aliasing XOR mutation, fully owned Rust collection. They just happen to have in degree greater one.
Right. Okay. So a doubly linked list that's not in some kind of concurrent context, or like a graph data structure that's like not in some kind of concurrent context.
Yeah, like the standard library linked list, like that kind of API, which is internally, it's a double linked list, but it's internally implemented using raw pointers and unsafe, that kind of API.
Right. So kind of as you were talking about the idea behind Ghost Cell, what you all again kind of came up with in this paper is this notion that, okay, with kind of the standard way of doing it using interior mutability, the kind of permissions control is too fine grained. Right. So again, with a doubly linked list where you have every single node essentially being protected with some kind of cell or a mutex or something like that. Again, that it doesn't make sense to have to do that if, especially, you know, for example, we only ever planned on iterate through that doubly linked list, then we should be getting better performance than the old strategy. And so what I thought was really cool and interesting and fascinating with Ghost Cell was just really that observation, right? To just be like, okay, you know, again, it turns out this granularity that we're using here is for these particular data structures is just too strict. So what we're going to try to do is like loosen this. We're going to loosen it so that really to something much more similar to a VEC example, like with what you were talking about earlier, what we want is protection or permissions on the entire collection instead of on the kind of interior nodes of the collection. And then as a consequence of that, this tool kind of, I suppose, if you want to call it that, that kind of fell out of that. I don't want to say fell out. I'm sure didn't just fall out. Maybe I should say this kind of separate API or separate library or crate that came out of this observation and how you all kind of like laid that out in the paper. It just was so fascinating to me that, because I very distinctly remember when I was first reading it, I was like, this is like, it's such like an elegant and yet at the same time kind of a novel idea. Where again, now with the whole Ghost Cell API, you're kind of separating those permissions to say, okay, we're going to kind of split this up into these two types where we're going to have, so you have this type called a ghost token. Pair that with a ghost cell where whoever owns or has shared access to the token then gets shared access to the ghost cell itself or the whatever is being wrapped inside of the ghost cell.
That's the key idea, right? So at this point, credit where credit is due. I should mention that this was originally developed by Joshua Janowski as part of, if I recall correctly, doing a Rust implementation of a checker for the Koch theorem prover, for this proof assistant that that we use to do our machine check proofs, which involves, there's these, in this data structures, what you are doing there is you have a big Lambda calculus style language, which is going to be a big, you have lots of, well, you have basically a huge graph and you're doing reduction and all sorts of graph traversals. And as part of this, we are not familiar with the details, but as part of this, he came up with this data structure and then started presenting it to us. And like the reaction was at the beginning for me, like it was probably was for everyone else. I was like, this makes no sense. What is even going on here? And then you start to realize it. And then, and at some point you're like, oh wow, this actually makes a lot of sense. At some point it clicks and then it begins to sink in. And it took us a while to get to this framing of this is separating permission from data. In the beginning, that's not how we thought about it. We just realized at some point that's a good way to explain it. That you basically, what you end up doing is you say, we have this integer greater one structure. So Rust has just no chance of doing this tracking. So we are just going to consider the structure as a separate entity existing somewhere. There's just this pure idea of just this, all this data sitting somewhere which has links. And then separately, we have the concept of somebody who's allowed to traverse that web of links. And it could either be one exclusive kind of traversal when you have a full unique access to that ghost token, or there's many shared accesses to the ghost tokens. So that means there's lots of threads doing traversals over all of these links at the same time. But conceptually, if you want to think of this in terms of Rust ownership, then really the ownership for all of the contents of all of these ghost cells is sitting in the token, not in the cells. The cells are just a shallow like skeleton of the structure. And the ghost token is doing all the ownership lifting. That's, of course, not how the data looks like in memory, but I think that's the easiest way to think about this. That means then that whenever you hold that token, that means you have the ownership. That means you can start working on the contents of all of those ghost sets.
Going back a little bit to what you were saying, so it sounded like this kind of came about as a need because of what Joshua was working on.
Yeah, he wanted to do like concurrent graph traversals where threads are, all sorts of threads are adding stuff to the graph and changing links in the graph. And he wanted to do this all in safe code.
And so kind of this ghost cell idea then came about in order to kind of fix that original solution or that original problem?
Yeah, to make it possible to write that higher level data structure in safe code, right? Like, of course, you can do everything in Rust if you use unsafe code. But some people aren't very satisfied by that, and rightly so, right? Ideally, we'd like to have a safe abstraction where, of course, there's unsafe code inside Ghost Cell, but you can do that once and look at it very carefully, or you do the proof, and then you don't need to worry about it anymore, because now you just use that library and you write all of your higher level stuff in safe code and you're good. Kind of really home, like kind of satisfying this promise of Rust that you can do all of this safely.
It sounds like the research into Ghost Token started off as a consequence of the earlier problem that you were talking about. And then that work kind of came out of that.
Yeah. So then the API was developed. And once Josh had developed it, we were like, well, we sure would like to prove its correctness. I mean, that's the obvious. Anyway, when you are a PL researcher in kind of our group, that's the obvious next question is like, nice data structure. How can we prove it correct? And that took a while. That took like more than a year, I think. And again, the proof was mostly done by Josh. Until we then got to the paper, yes. And then it also took two attempts to get the paper into a shape where it was accepted at a conference.
Gotcha. Reminds me of a particular XKCD comic where he kind of lays out the different classifications of all the different academic papers. Have you seen this one?
There was a recent one which has like 9 papers with like...
Yeah.
All research papers are like this. Yeah. I mean, I had to laugh hard and then send it to all my academic friends.
Yeah. So it's just like, well, we were working on something else. And then out of that work, there was something interesting that we pursued. And then some more work. This is like the paper that came out of
that. Yeah, I mean, that XKCD is pretty accurate.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure all of his comics are pretty accurate.
Yeah.
So continue on in the paper. There then goes on to kind of detail, I suppose, an alternate doubly linked list implementation. To be totally transparent, I didn't get through the entire paper, so I don't know if there was like a graph implementation included in there.
No, there wasn't. No, that's one of the things the reviewers complained about.
cool. But yeah, I just thought the resulting API was also just very elegant. And it was also mentioned in the paper how when you're looking at the type signature for ghost token and ghost cell, how you have this idea of branded types, but in order to actually implement that in Rust, you're kind of hacking the lifetime system a little bit because you're using lifetime identifiers as kind of the way to pair the ghost token with the ghost cell itself. And again, kind of like commandeering the lifetime machinery in order to kind of get that to work, which I thought was really interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the workhorse to some extent of this library, right? Like I mentioned earlier, the permissions are split and we have the ghost token that holds all the ownership and we have the ghost cell that holds all the data. But of course, you can't entirely lose the connection between the ownership and the data, because if you would use the wrong ownership for the wrong data, clearly everything would just go horribly wrong. So you need to somehow connect the two, and clearly you don't want to do this with any kind of runtime checks, because the entire point is to not have runtime checks. And so that's where this idea of branding comes in, which is an old idea in the PL literature. Probably the most well-known instance in at least some circles is Haskell's ref type. Now, I'm not a Haskell expert, so I'm probably going to get half the details wrong here. But there's this concept there that you have a type of references that's indexed by some type parameter alpha, which is just an abstract type. Like nobody ever tells you what alpha is. And so when you have a ref alpha and a ref beta, you have no way of mixing them up because you don't know what alpha and beta are. They might be different, they might be the same. You have to just treat it completely symbolically. And so when you have a ref alpha and you are inside a function that is working on the alpha heap as part of its monad signature, you know you can use that reference because it matches your heap. And then there is the famous runst function, which you can safely in Haskell run imperative code essentially without any imperative side effects. And essentially what this boils down to is that you have a component, a part of your type, of you have a higher kind of type, like how ghost cell is parameterized over the lifetime, or like how vec is parameterized over the type. And then you have code where that instance of that higher kind of type is unknown to the code. The code is written in a way that for all types T, it works with vec of T. That basically means it can't do anything with that T except for like pushing and popping. Like it can't even clone because it doesn't know it's clonable. It can't add its own elements or remove or something. It's very restricted in what it can do. And the same in Rust, you can do. You cannot do this in Rust the way you do it in Haskell, because in Rust, we cannot write functions, closures that are polymorphic over a type. Rust just doesn't support this because monomorphization wouldn't work. But Rust does support this with lifetimes. Right? You can write a function in Rust that's polymorphic over a lifetime. That much is boring. But more importantly, you can in Rust have a function pointer to a function that's polymorphic over a lifetime. And that works because lifetimes are completely a compile time only ghost concept. So a single function pointer can be correct for many, many lifetimes, basically. So you have this function type, which is for all alpha, fn of ampersand alpha something to ampersand alpha something. And you can have a function pointer, which you can then, at runtime, kind of decide which alpha to use. And this is what we call rank 2 polymorphism in the literature, but that's just a fancy word for having a function pointer that has a for all in it. And that idea is not ours at all. I saw that the first time in 2016, I think. It was originally developed by Gankro, or Alexis Bein. I'm going to mispronounce the last name, so I'm not going to try. And they had this idea to do that as part of an API for unchecked indexing, for safely using indices into a vector without doing runtime checks, because you already checked earlier that they were correct. And then again, you need to make sure that you're not, that once you checked an index to be correct in some vector, you cannot mix up the index you checked for one vector with another vector. And so that's when this idea of using lifetimes in Rust for that purpose was born. And then Josh took that idea and used it for Ghost Cell.
Very cool. I have to admit, my brain's overheating a little bit.
Yeah. That's rank 2 polymorphism are generally higher, higher order function tends to do that with your brain. It's much easier to just program it and look at the API docs, and then it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But to abstractly think about it in your head, brains easily melt. That's normal.
Do you think Ghost Cell has a good chance of kind of like making it into Rust standard library? Like, do you think this work is kind of, or this kind of like abstraction is important enough to kind of be included? And, you know, mostly more concretely, what I'm thinking is like, should the standard library's linked list take the implementation that was laid out in the paper and use that as Rust's kind of canonical standard library linked list implementation?
I think I can answer the second question first, because the answer is probably no.
Okay.
Because as I mean, as much as I like Ghost Cell, it does have some limitations, and we cannot implement the full linked list API in the standard library using Ghost Cell in SafeCode. And the most glaring hole is the mutable iterator. So iterators, in particular, iterators and Rust are very powerful, in particular, the ones that give out mutable references, these itermute style iterators. They're very powerful because in Rust, when you in that iterator, you can access all of the elements that you got from the iterator at the same time. Right? So you're calling itermute, and then you're calling next a couple times. And each time you call next, you get a mutable reference to the next element. And they all have the same lifetime, which is the lifetime of the entire iteration. So you have all of these mutable references, which means they definitely don't alias. Right? Because it's not like you could imagine another API where before you call next again, you have to stop using the previous mutable reference.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be more like a stream. And you could express this in Rust once we have higher ranked, like what's called generic associated types. But currently you can't express this. So the iterator API that Rust has is much more powerful. And there's no way to implement that with Ghost Cell because Ghost Cell doesn't know, like when you have a doubly linked list, with Ghost Cell, you're able to traverse it and do all sorts of stuff. But Ghost Cell doesn't represent the fact that all of these nodes in the doubly linked list are different, are distinct. Like all of the type, as far as Ghost Cell and all of these types are concerned, there could be cycles. Could be just a doubly linked list that's closing in a loop on itself. And all of the functions we wrote would be completely fine with this. But itermute would not, because it would start out giving a mutable reference to the same element again. And Ghost Cell can't know that. We're not doing any runtime checks or equality checks, and our invariants are very local. We're just saying each link, the thing behind the pointer is also a valid node. That's our only invariant, basically. That's expressed in the type. The actual linked list implementation in Rust, in the standard library, has a much more global invariant, namely that it is acyclic. If there would be, ever be a cycle in there, itermute would be wrong. So there is it's very important for this linked list's correctness that it is acyclic. And that is not an invariant that is easily expressed locally just in the types. And it is not an invariant that Ghost Cell can express. So there's still a cliff between the full API you might want and the API you can get in SafeCode. And I think this is a pretty hard to surmount cliff, precisely because the invariant you need is this kind of acyclicity, which doesn't naturally lend itself to a local formulation. There are ways. I'm not familiar with the details. There are things you could try to do that would probably make the API even less ergonomic. And I guess that's the other point, right? Ergonomics. Like our linked list is less ergonomic than a doubly linked list one because you need to have this ghost token and there's this brand and you need to carry it around and you need to call this type 2 rank 2 polymorphism function, this fancy thing for ghost token new, which generates the fresh lifetime. So you basically, it's a closure callback based API at that point. So I think it's a very interesting case study. I think it can be useful. I don't think it doesn't give the best ergonomic APIs. So for really fundamental things like the linked listeners and library, I don't think it's the right choice.
Gotcha. So that would kind of be your argument as to why it shouldn't even be included in like the standard library more generally.
I mean, for that, I guess the question is, does it need to be, right? Like the standard library needs to contain vocabulary types that are important to define the API boundary between crates so that we can compose things. I'm not sure if Ghost Cell is such a type. It's more of an internal thing.
Right, that makes sense.
So if it exists as a crate, people can still easily use it. And thankfully, Mathieu M. has already taken our code, or rather actually rewrote it, and made it a crate, so it's available. And it turns out it was already available before as part of the Q-cell crate. So Josh had posted this idea years ago already on Reddit for this API. And then somebody took it and developed the Q-cell crate, which has a bunch of very interesting cell types that are all based on this idea of separating permission from data. But one of it uses this branding, but there are also others that use runtime checks to some extent. So there's you have some kind of trade-off here. So they have some runtime checks, but less than you would have had otherwise, and they are simpler. And in particular, data is read-only. So one of the really bad things about iterating over a mutex-protected linked list is that your read-only iteration becomes mutating because you have to change the mutex state. CPUs really don't like that. Whereas with all of these cell types in the Q-cell crate, it remains read-only, even if there are still some runtime checks. But they get rid of the brand, which makes ergonomics better. You could potentially have itermute, which with some more runtime checks about pointer inequalities. So I think there is a interesting design space of these kinds of cell types there. And they are out there, and people can play with them. And I think that's one of the great things about Rust, that we can just put out these libraries, and then other people can build stuff on them.
What are some of those kind of then extensions on top of GhostCell that you were alluding to earlier? Use cases or like things that could be built on top of GhostCell that maybe would be like more useful?
Yeah, I mean, so at this point, my problem is that I'm more of a PL researcher than an actual practical software engineer. So I don't actually know what people do with Rust. I just make sure Rust makes sense. That's not entirely true, but kind of. I mean, so MathUM did this because they went ahead and actually wrote a linked list implementation in it. It doesn't have Itermute, but it's much more complete than the toy linked list we had in our paper. And they did that by combining it. So one of the things that's also, if people go read in the paper, is, I mean, GhostCell handles ownership for you. You still need to do memory management. Like, I mean, Rust doesn't do garbage collection, right? So you still need to figure out what to do there. And when you have a pointer-based, pointer-heavy data structure, this becomes less trivial, right? If in a tree, you use boxes, and it's, again, very clear when the box is dropped, like ownership and memory management tends to be tightly coupled in Rust. But once you separate permission from data, you cannot do that anymore. So you have to figure out what to do with memory management. And the two obvious choices are reference counting and arenas, which are kind of two ways of semi-automatic memory management in Rust, which all of them, like, they have pros and cons. Reference counting has one-time overhead. Arenas, you can only deallocate the entire thing. And so what MathUM did is a really ingenious trick with a separate create called static RC that is basically reference counting, but at compile time.
Oh.
I have not looked at it in detail, so I won't like vet for its soundness, but the basic idea certainly should work. And it's an amazingly creative use of const generics. It's an implementation of what we call fractional permissions in the separation logic literature. And it's basically doing the reference counting of an RC at compile time. And I love it.
That's really cool.
And so then you end up with a linked list that doesn't have the arena problem. So like stuff is deallocated as early as it can, but also there's no runtime at all for all the reference counting because it's compile time reference counting. And it still doesn't have Itermute, but otherwise, other than that, it has a pretty good API, pretty solid API server, and it's completely safe code. Static RC is unsafe, of course. That's a separate library that hopefully at some point somebody will prove correct. But then you can do the linked list and also a tree and all sorts of other things safely on top of that. And I think, I mean, this just started. I'm very curious to see what will come. I mean, I in no way did I expect this GhostCell thing to be, that the Rust community would be so excited about it. It's really amazing to see this kind of reaction so quickly. It's not even an officially published paper yet. It's just a draft we put out there, like a preprint. And we already have derived work. I just love this.
Yeah, it's very cool to see.
And I guess another thing that, because we were talking about use cases, so there's something that I really love about GhostCell, just from thinking about it. I mean, so one thing that we love about it is that it doesn't actually do anything. Like if you look at the GhostCell code, the code that doesn't do anything, every single one of the GhostCell functions is a knob. The only thing that happens is in the types. It's completely a type-only library and a couple of transmutes that don't do anything. And it's just a bit mind-boggling that that can actually be useful. And it tells you something about the power of a type system.
Yeah.
Right. People tend to think of type systems as like restricting you so that you cannot write certain kinds of programs, ruling out the bad programs, sorting the bad programs from the good programs, right? And I think that's a very narrow view of what a type system is, because it doesn't just restrict you, it also enables you. It enables you to think about programs in a whole new way. And the fact that we have here a library that's, if you ignore the types, it's literally doing nothing. And still it is very interesting and useful, and you can write a full paper about it. I think that tells you something about how types are much more than just restricting the set of code you can write.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It kind of reminds me of just like web frameworks a little bit, where, because it's like when you choose some web framework to, you know, write a web application in, you pick it not so much. I mean, sometimes you pick it for like the tools it provides, but like for the most part, you like could do all that functionality yourself by hand, right? But I think what really the most powerful aspect of frameworks in general is, well, the framework, right? It's like it's kind of shoehorning you into like thinking about this problem in a certain way, right? And that maybe just makes it easier to focus on the more interesting problems while kind of like delegating a lot of the other kind of boring or boilerplate stuff kind of, or abstracting that away, if that makes sense. So I don't know if that's like a perfect analogy, but it sounds a little bit similar.
Yeah, I think I get it. I mean, I think one way to say it is that it gives you some kind of vocabulary, right? To really talk about this at a higher level. Like you don't talk about your Rust program in terms of individual machine registers, because we have a higher level way of talking about these programs and we don't need to go to the basement to figure out what happens. And just having that, and sometimes it's just even finding the vocabulary is hard. But once you have it, it's really liberating because now finally you have the words and the terms and the language to talk about these things that you knew were there because you kind of have it in your intuition. But it's pinpointing them is a really hard problem.
It's really funny when you were pointing out that all of the functions in the library, in the GoCell library, are all no-ops. Like, really what that means is, like, at the computer's level, like, it doesn't care. It doesn't see anything different. This is all just for the sake of humans working with other humans.
Yeah.
And obviously the machine is kind of in the in-between, but, like, again, it's just, like, people are talking above it, and it's just, like, what are you saying? Like, I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, yes, there's literally, like, if you look at the assembly code, you wouldn't see that there ever was a ghost. That's why we called it ghost, right? It's this concept of ghost state and verification, of, like, things you do to your program that only exist for the purpose of verification. And one really nice kind of use case that I haven't seen it yet, but I just like that way of thinking about it, is let's say you have a graph, and, I mean, you're doing something like our doubly linked list in the paper. So you're protecting each graph, the fields, or some of the fields by a ghost cell. And now one thing you could actually do is you could have two brands for the graph. Right? So you don't have just one ghost token, you have two ghost tokens. And you put some of the fields of the graph in one ghost token, and so in ghost cells with one brand, and some of the fields in the graph in ghost cells with another brand, which has the advantage that you can access those fields at the same time on different nodes, right? Like, I don't know, in a graph, you might put the vector with the adjacency list for, like, the next nodes in one ghost cell, one brand. And then, I don't know, maybe on every node, you also have a Boolean, a bit for whether you visited the node already to do some kind of depth first search or something. And then you put that in a different ghost cell. So you can iterate over one, over this vector in one ghost cell while accessing that Boolean in the other ghost cell. You can do that because they are different brands, so their ownership is still separate. And if you think about what the type of such a node now looks like, right, you end up with, like, ghost cell tick brand 1, comma vec something, ghost cell tick brand 2, comma bool. Now, if you wanted to, I don't know, do that graph traversal in a concurrent way, what you would do is you would put the ghost token into a mutex or a reader writer log. Right, because that's how, in a world where permissions are separate from data, data is shared and free to be accessible for everyone. It's shared references everywhere, obviously. But, and then the permission, the token, is what you actually have to get access to access this thing. So you put the token into a mutex. And if you want to access the graph, you acquire the mutex. You have a mutable reference to the token. And you can use that mutable reference to access all of the fields. But now, if you have two brands, you can have two locks. And each of these tokens living in one lock. And now what this tick brand 1, tick brand 2 really means is it formalizes which field is protected by which lock. And we've probably all seen this code if we've written C++ or Java or something, where there's, like, a big struct and there's comments saying fields 1 to 5 are protected by that lock and fields 6 to 10 are protected by the other lock. With the ghost cell, we can actually make that into the type system so the compiler can see that structure. We can have a lock with the brand 1 token, and we can have some fields in the brand 1 ghost cell and they're protected by that lock. And we can have a lock with a brand 2 token, and we're going to have some fields in the brand 2 ghost cell and protected by that lock. So this informal comment of which fields are protected by which lock, we can now express in the type system, and the compiler will check that we are holding the lock we need to access the data we are accessing. And I just really love that idea that this is just yet another concept that's known to people. Everybody, like, who writes Java or C++ code with large amounts of fields has seen such code or written such code. But now we have precise vocabulary that the compiler can understand the code and can help us follow the rules, which, of course, is the Rust spirit, right?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So I'm looking forward to the first data structure that will do that. I want to see that. I haven't seen one yet, but I really want to see one.
I wanted to switch gears and maybe zoom out a little bit. You work as a PL researcher. I think we're going to talk a little bit about, like, this divide, I suppose, between kind of, like, academic PL research and kind of, like, what subset of that PL research ends up getting into, like, and influencing quote unquote mainstream languages. And this is, like, a conversation I've had with multiple people who are, like, really into diving into kind of esoteric and very, like, academically focused PLs, where a lot of them just kind of are a little saddened by the fact that it's, like, you know, there's all these problems that exist in quote unquote mainstream PLs that, well, were solved 40 years ago in academia. Like, why is there such a divide here? Like, what is the source of that? And like, why does that happen?
Why don't you all have subtypes? I mean, I really don't get it.
Yeah. And so I don't, like, obviously you are probably very entrenched in one of those camps. And I was curious if this is something you've thought about.
I mean, it's certainly at, like, I'm a big programming languages nerd. So this is the kind of discussion I like having over a beer with my fellow researchers or friends or stuff, right? And I mean, I did programming before I did research. My first language was C. So I'm coming very much from the mainstream languages without fancy type systems. Though once I did learn about fancy type system, I fell in love with them pretty quickly. Yeah, I mean, so one part of the question is, how do you define mainstream versus not mainstream, right? Like, arguably, OCaml and Haskell are, I don't know if they're mainstream, but they are not, like, they are probably on the same ballpark as Rust. Probably Rust is still behind them currently, though it's quickly taking up. Maybe that's just my bubble, because I obviously know that kind of people more than I would like your typical Java engineer. But those languages obviously have all these things, right? They have strong academic ties. But they also have strong industrial influence. I mean, there's companies using OCaml in production, there's companies using Haskell in production, and the feedbacking into the development as well. So in that sense, some of that, there you have some influence of academic research on, well, mainstream, I don't know, weekly mainstream languages. I don't know the audience for this podcast. If it's Rust programmers, I guess we can call these mainstream languages.
Sure, yeah.
I wasn't around when Java started. But as far as I understand, there was also a lot of academic influence there, right? Like, object orientation was the big thing in a lot of academic research. Generics that came in Java a bit after 1.0, but still were added. As far as I understand, there was a lot of influence from academia with that one. So it's not entirely a new thing. But yeah, it's like, some types are probably my pet peeve. Like, just, I mean, in Rust we call them enums, of course. Like, enums with data in their variants, for some reason, are really, really rare. And I don't understand why. They're just amazing. Like, once you have them, you can, I don't know how you can program without them ever again. And some, I mean, obviously Haskell and OCaml have them, but the other round of recent type languages doesn't really have them, right? Go doesn't, and Swift, as far as I understand, only has an option type, but I don't know their support for full enums. Actually, Swift might have them, I don't know. I'm not enough of a Swift expert. And I mean, the wave of languages before that was very weakly typed, right? That was the wave of JavaScript and Rubies and Pythons. So there wasn't much going on there in the type system space. So from perspective of a type system nerd, that was just a kind of dark age situation. So I'm very happy we're now again in an age of typed languages. Now, nothing wrong with JavaScript. Like, it's you can get a lot of stuff done in JavaScript. I just really like type systems. So
yeah. TypeScript must be a bit of a...
Yeah, TypeScript is great. I haven't looked at it in detail, but yes. I mean, in particular, being able to actually ship this into the JavaScript ecosystem like a decade after that has been established is an impressive engineering feat. And the type system also seemed like, of course, has very different trade-offs in terms of your type system, because you have to work with all the untyped code out there. And again, there has been a lot of academic research there, gradual types. I'm not an expert, but I hear things about it at conferences all the time. And I'm sure TypeScript was heavily influenced by that.
Here's a question then. We mentioned some types. Is there, if you could like wave a magic wand and kind of say, okay, this one PL feature that maybe is very like ubiquitous in academia, but like not at all present in mainstream languages, is there one that you would just wave a magic wand and be like, okay, I want this in all the mainstream languages? Like, if this was just in Go and Python and JavaScript and et cetera, like, this would make all of these PLs a lot better and actually like improve a lot of people's lives and workflows. They just don't know it yet.
That's, I mean, I think 10 years ago I would have said closures, but actually closures are being rolled out like all over the place. Not just recently. I mean, C++ has closures since C++ 11, I think. Obviously, Python has had closures from the beginning. Java had function objects, but they got made more into usual closure behavior. In Python, they behaved a bit strangely, but you can still mostly use them. Though, I mean, I guess in Python closures are a bit disappointing, because you have this little small expression in there. For anything large, you still need to write a proper def. But I mean, that's nitty-gritties. So, and obviously Scala and Java have closures. Scala had them from the beginning, Java got them, and Go and Swift and all the others. So I think that wish actually got fulfilled. I mean, I don't think there's anything on the level of some types. Generics are another obvious thing, but most languages do have some form of generics, right? I mean, C doesn't, Go doesn't. Java and Python stuff don't have types, so there's not much to talk about there. But and Go is getting generics, if I understand. That's probably the main other thing. I mean, I guess something else that really impressed me about Rust was its macro system. That's there's a lot of Lisp scheme influence there, which again, lots of academic stuff happening there. I'm not a schemer or a Lisper, so I can't really do justice to those languages. But that's, having been burnt by C macros before, the Rust macro system was just such a delight, having this focus on hygiene, which, I mean, they got it right for variables, but there's still some hygiene stuff missing. I hope we'll get proper macro 2.0 at some point. That might be the other thing that, like, I mean, when I learned about Rust, I was already a PL researcher, and so much of it was just a dream come true. Right? You go over the language features, and every time you turn the page or scroll down to the next like thing in the Rust tutorial, it's yet another part of the design space. And I was like, yes, they also got that one right. I mean, I obviously extremely subjective, but I fell in love with Rust pretty quickly when I looked at it around 2015 or something, in seriousness for the first time, around the 1.0 release. I guess I would put macros on the first space, but they are nowhere near some types. So some types just win.
That's fair. And yeah, my impression of like Haskell has always been, it's like been very much the mainstream kind of like academic playground language, maybe before Rust came around. Like, has Rust kind of taken some of that market share away from Haskell, would you say?
I mean, it's hard for me to say because I was never a Haskeller. Like, I've dabbled in Haskell, but I've not really programmed much in it. So I hope not. Like, I think Rust and Haskell should be good friends. Rust learned a lot from Haskell. Maybe Haskell can at some point learn something from Rust as well. So I hope not. But I hope it's going to be more like Rust is pulling C programmers onto the side of strong type systems, and then once they got hooked on Rust, maybe they would also like Haskell more because all this weird type system stuff they're already familiar with.
But when I kind of like read through a lot of Rust RFCs, it definitely makes me wish I had more of a background in a lot of kind of PL theory, because you're throwing around all these terms like the generic associated types, and it took me a while to even, you know, understand what const generics even really were for a while, and I still feel fuzzy on it. But it's like all these things that I'm reading about in RFCs, all these features that are being mentioned in the blog posts for each of the Rust releases, it's like, gosh, I wish I like had more of a foundation in this topic so I could kind of like understand some of this a bit more. So I could see that in a lot of cases, perhaps even being like not necessarily alienating, but like someone who just kind of like uses Rust for their job and is not a PL nerd, like maybe just sees those blog posts and is just like, okay, whatever, like more things that I don't really need for my job or I don't really care about. It's kind of like one thing that I worry a little bit if that would ever be like a turnoff for Rust, because it's just like Rust is already a large language and it just keeps getting larger and larger with all of these new type system features and stuff that are getting added in. And so I wonder, is there ever a point where it's like, this is too much and we need to like tone it down a little bit?
I mean, it's certainly worrying if you say that these release notes are getting incomprehensible because of type system jargon. We should work on that. That said, const generics might sound like a weird thing, but C++ has it, right? Like, it's, I don't know what they call it, but you have like integer template arguments or generally non-type template arguments. So you don't need to go to a heavily PL-influenced language to have some feature like that. When is it going to end? I mean, I don't know. I'm not on the Lang team, so lucky enough, I don't have to make such decisions. There are some features that are fairly common that Rust doesn't have yet. In particular, generic associated types, which you mentioned, which basically just means being able to have type constructors in your traits. Like it's, currently our traits can contain types, but if you want to have a trait which contains like the vec type constructor, something to which you can give a type to get out a type that is of the shape type to type, you cannot put that into a trait. You cannot, for example, like one of the most obvious use cases, you want to write code that abstracts over whether you use RC or ARC. Mm-hmm. But you want to put various kinds of data into it. Like you want to have all sorts of custom types into your RC arc, but you want to abstract it over that RC versus arc thing. So you really want to abstract over that constructor that turns a type into the smart pointer to the type. And that could be really useful because then you could have a thread safe and a non-thread safe version of your library. You just write the code once, you instantiate it with RC, you instantiate it with arc, you get the libraries you want. Right? And currently in Rust, you can kind of hack something like that. It doesn't, I'm not sure how far it goes, but you would really just want to have a trait where this RC or arc are elements, like associated elements in the trait. And then that would be much easier. And so I hope we get that. I hope we get specialization. People ask for that all the time. Beyond that, I don't know. Like, those are the two major things that have been talked about for years. And I wouldn't know that discussions have added more things beyond that. There's always more things we could add, but those two have accumulated enough use cases that I personally feel like it's worth it. And they would kind of get us onto, well, not feature parity with Haskell and all of its flags for sure. Expressivity would get us much closer to the kind of things you can express in the type systems of OCaml or Haskell. And that would probably cover the vast majority of things, and it would hopefully not be too hard to use or not be too incomprehensible. I hope we see these two, and then beyond that, you always have to weigh, obviously, complexity against usefulness of the feature. If you look at the recent Rust change logs, it's not like each Rust release adds like 15 terribly exciting type system features. Like, the last release added a bunch of function stabilizations. There was not much going on there. And that's great. Like, it's a sign of maturing. But sometimes we have like const generics, and that's great. That's also great. But we don't have that like every other month. So I think it has slowed down, and I think it will continue to slow down. But I do want to see specialization and generic associated types. that's just like, I don't know, every couple of months something comes up in the forums or the chat. Like, yeah, we could do this really nicely if we had just that one feature.
Gotcha.
And also, I mean, both of them are tied up with chalk. Chalk is this project to re-engineer the Rust trait system solver to into a separate crate, which has tons of engineering benefits, like having your VS Code integration just directly use the same solver. But also, from a formalization perspective, at some point I would like to prove things about the Rust trait system, and currently that's really hard, because what is the Rust trait system? Like, it's, I don't know how many thousand lines of code implemented like in very imperative style. It's probably not very imperative. I'm sure it's very well engineered, but it's a lot of code, and it's implicit. With chalk, you get a much more explicit style. Like, you're generating clauses in a logic program. You're generating a specification in a very well-defined language. At that point, we just have to formalize that way of translating your Rust code into this set of clauses, which I think will be reasonable. And then everything else is precisely formally defined. That's every PI researcher's dream. Now you can start proving theorems. It will be hard to prove these theorems, but it's possible. So chalk is I'm really looking forward to chalk, and then that's kind of the foundation for both of these type system features, specialization and generic associated types.
Gotcha. So you being a PL researcher, I'm assuming obviously there's other languages you're working in besides Rust. Although, correct me if I'm wrong, Rust is probably like where you spend most of your time or most of your working time.
Yeah, I mean, Rust is and has been since Rust 1.0 my home language. I mean, before that, I've been kind of wandering around. As I mentioned, I started with C, I picked up C++, I picked up quite a few languages. I really enjoyed Python. I didn't personally enjoy JavaScript terribly much, but that's just my taste. And I was going to look into Haskell. It was kind of on my list. I wasn't not really, I would never have, would have called any of these languages like my home language. Rust, I would call my home language. Like, with Rust, I found a language where, I mean, of course, there's things to complain about. Like, everything you love, you have a long list of things you don't like about it, right? Sure. But the general structure of it is just exactly right up my alley. So currently, I feel pretty good just doing, like, focusing my effort mostly on Rust. I do other research, but that research is not language specific, right? Like, I do research on developing a logic framework called Iris, which we use to formally verify things about programs and programming languages. It's also the foundation of the Rust Belt and Ghost Cell proofs. But that is mostly language agnostic. Like, we have a little toy language that we use to build our models and stuff. But it's about algorithms. It's not about a particular programming language. So there's not really any other programming language besides Rust that I'm directly doing much with. Any real programming language. I mean, of course, like lambda calculus, but you wouldn't count that.
Cool. Let's cap off this conversation with one last question. And I've always toyed around with the idea of wanting to go into research. And this is me just kind of like having dreamy thoughts. But, you know, like doing some kind of research in like systems would be cool, or alternatively in programming languages would also be kind of cool. And again, these are very kind of like far off dreams. And I always tell people that like, if I were ever to kind of pursue research, it would be in like 20 years time when our currently non-existent children are like off on college on their own. And, you know, we don't have any kind of like financial constraints tying us down. And at which point I could go ahead and take presumably a large pay cut to go ahead and just go do research with a bunch of young 20 something whippersnappers or something. Like, that sounds really fun to me. Kind of on that note, what do you think are some signs that maybe you would be a good PL researcher?
I'm not a professor yet, and you're asking me these tough questions. I don't know. I mean, I can obviously talk about my personal story, but that's a very individual story. I always love math as far as my memory goes back, and I loved programming the moment I saw it, also still as a child. So and PL is a great combination of programming and math, because you're talking about programming languages, so like the programming is always there, even if you're not like sitting there and actually doing hard code like C++ coding. But I mean, knowing something about the tricks that C++ coders use is totally useful. But there's also all the math everywhere, like you're doing proofs. And so for me, it's a great combination of my love for math and my love for programming. If you really don't like math at all, then PL maybe is not for you. Though, I mean, I should immediately say here, math isn't what you do in high school. Like the thing, well, I don't know basically anything about US high schools, but the thing they teach here about math is like all about numbers.
It sounds about right, yeah.
And that's not the kind of math I'm talking about. Like if you don't like doing derivatives, that's completely fine. I don't like doing derivatives. I don't like real numbers, in fact. Like the moment you do anything, we come with real numbers, like I'm out. It's by math, I mean just abstract, logical, symbolical thinking. Like given a bunch of rules, it's almost like a game. Given a bunch of rules that you have to follow to the letter, but that are very abstract, but you can fill them with intuition usually, and that's extremely helpful. Play by these rules and figure out a way to win the game, which is to complete the proof. And so you should have a hang for that, I think, if you want to do PL. Proofs these days are often done with a computer. I wouldn't trust the proofs we had done for Ghost Cell if we hadn't them checked by the computer, because it's just too many things going on. Like, it's too easy to miss a side condition. And in particular, when you're working with three people on one proof, it's really easy for person A to think B did the check, and B thinks A did the check, and then nobody did the check, and then it just goes wrong. And doing proofs in the computer is almost kind of a weird kind of programming. Like, we are literally doing software engineering. We have our proofs in the Git repository. We have merge requests. We have issues. We have continuous integration. We're doing code review. We are doing API design. We are like bike chatting about style and function names and stuff like that. It's a kind of programming. It's different from normal programming, but it is a kind of programming. So the programming part is probably more important than the math part. If you're a good programmer, you can learn the math part, I'm sure. I don't know much about systems, but I've discovered by accident that they are actually closer than I thought. Like, I mean, I did my PhD in PL, and I'm going to do my postdoc at a systems group at MIT. So the jump isn't, and they are already using PL techniques. It's a verification systems group. So, I mean, they're kind of on that side of the spectrum of systems, but still. It's systems people, turns out, who would have thought, actually care about their systems being correct. and when you start and go about proving that, you're not far from doing PL.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Cool. Probably go ahead and wrap up the conversation here. I want to thank you so much for your time, Ralph. I know it's late where you are, so I don't want to keep you up.
This has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much for having me, Sean.
Yeah, I wanted to go ahead and let you, if you wanted to plug any social media handles, I don't know if you...
I mean, I have a blog. I'm not big on social media. I'm kind of not into that game. Yeah, no, if you Google me with Rust, I'm sure you will find... You will find my blog, and where I share all sorts of things about thinking about all sorts of Rust stuff, and sometimes some non-Rust stuff too.
Yeah, I'm sure in your case you just want the stuff you actually put out to be published, like the Ghost Cell paper, to actually be read, and not much more than that is what it sounds like.
Well, I mean, blog posts are very different kind of publishing than papers, and it's a lot of fun to write like that sometimes. And like the interactions in particular, like it's been a lot of fun to do this Rust blog post. Because most of the time I get great discussions afterwards on the various Rust discussion channels. I know it's been said 1,000 times, but I like Rust is also its community. And it's also, as an academic researcher, I'm really happy with how welcoming the community is to people that come in and like throw math at everything and put Greek letters everywhere and make everything needlessly complicated. and that like people have faith that what we're doing can actually be useful and help them. I'm really grateful for that and that they give us the chance to work with them.
Well, we're just as grateful to you and to your collaborators as well for doing all of that research in the first place. That concludes this episode of Building with Rust. The music you heard at the beginning of the episode was performed by Andre Logic Bogus and written by Jonathan Colton. If you liked what you heard, please leave us a review on your podcasting platform of choice. You can also email us at buildingwithrust@gmail.com to suggest projects or people in the Rust ecosystem with whom you'd like us to talk to on this podcast. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. We'll see you in the next one.